Hello, I'm Ian Johnson from the University of Sydney, and I've been involved in developing software for the humanities, specifically archaeology, because that's my training, and later covering a much broader range of historical and other sorts of humanities data since the ni early 1980s. A good point to start is this statement that was made to me at a meeting, the first and last consultation meeting. With the CEO of a large e-research organization, more than 50 staff and a team of programmers, for to which I was a consultant on the redevelopment of some software that we developed called Field Helper over the previous years. Academics don't know how to write software, you should leave it to the professionals. This is the first version of that software, a second version a couple of years later, a bit more sophisticated, and the e-research organization took over the development and produced something like this, which is a kind of glorified file manager with metadata editing in a forms-based form, after about 6 months' work and $250,000, using all the right techniques, agile development, unit testing, and so forth. Now, this is not a critique of the developers who did exactly what their managers told them, but what ended up was a technically perfect result, very, very good, but a poor fit for purpose. And as a result, as far as I know, it was used by one person who was the product owner and abandoned after a couple of years. They were not very happy with it. So academics may not know how to write software, but who better to define the needs of our profession? And that profession's pretty broad because the humanities ranges everything from archaeology, history, linguistics, art history, and so forth. So, what sort of person, what is required to manage software development in the humanities? First of all, obviously, you need to understand the domain of the humanities, which is a pretty broad domain. Secondly, you need to understand the needs of researchers and also the needs of public access, which is becoming increasingly important in terms of relevance. So these lead to basically being a researcher in the humanities and having an understanding of that. Thirdly, you need enough understanding of the technological possibilities of what can be done so that you can translate what's needed in terms of the actual application into what can be done with the technology. And the ability to bridge the divide between researchers with their particular viewpoint on the world and particular types of dialogue with developers who have a different view on the world and a different set of terminology. So one of the things that I think is very important, which was lacking in this previous example, was mutual respect between the researchers and the developers, and a bit of humility because it is certain that the other side of the divide knows far, far more about their side of the divide than you do, and vice versa. So one of the things about humanities data are they are very interesting. So we have wonderful, interesting data to do with text, media, objects, people, places, events, a lot of heterogeneous data, sparse matrices, richly linked data about people, events, archaeology, museums, books and manuscripts and religion and networks and all of this sort of stuff. That was a bad bit of animation. So this has led to an area known as the digital humanities. Some people think it's a fad, some people think it's a domain or discipline, which is really a large part of it is about the application of new technologies, obvious things like personal computers and phones and so forth, through the availability of massively digitized archives, which allows research that you could never do before, the internet, which allows both research, databases, distributed work, and access to things that were never available before, and different ways of presentation to the public and to other researchers, and technical tools which are particularly relevant, for instance, to archaeology, such as GPS, 3D, and LiDAR. And LiDAR is a very good example of exciting new opportunities for research and public engagement because it has totally revolutionized the way that we can map cities in the tropical forests, such as in Central America or in Southeast Asia, which were pretty much inaccessible or could only be mapped very roughly before, but now can be mapped in incredible detail, looking straight through the trees. But the missing link about and all of this for many, many smaller applications is an easy way of building and publishing complex databases, and particularly publishing them on the web. And There are obviously tools like Access and FileMaker and Excel for desktop applications, but there are many problems with those, as I'm sure you're all aware. So I like to use the idea of the digital Sherpa. So the digital Sherpa is tools or a tool set that allows you to climb the mountain, not the traditional way of hard grind and perhaps falling off the top and killing yourself, but taking the bus to the parking lot and then walking up or climbing up the last little bit, which is probably the most interesting bit, where you have the best views, at least if you're not really convinced that you want to do climbing. So I think of Heurist, the software we've developed, as a digital Sherpa, which helps people do the digital humanities. So I've been thinking about this for a long time, and back in 2013, I gave a paper at a conference where I compared the sort of three models of development, the engineering model that we've seen in the previous example, where a team of developers will develop something according to a set of specifications. Now, the problem with that tends to be that it requires a lot of upfront design. Researchers very often don't know exactly what they need at the beginning, and it hinders the creativity of being able to adapt to new ideas as they come along. At the other end of the scale, you have the scholar programmer who does it all themselves. They will have the most creativity, they will see new things to do and be able to do it, but they probably don't have the level of training, the technical training, to produce software that is not just good for them, but is good for a broader set of people. There are exceptions, of course. But in the middle, you have the concept, I'd say, of the scholar analyst and a technical team, where the scholar analyst is able to talk the language of both sides, of the researchers and of the technical developers, and has that understanding to be able to communicate what's needed and also to keep things in sync between the two sides. And we see an example, this is another example of another Australian project, where it was designed by archaeologists. In fact, about 50 archaeologists got together for a couple of days and talked all about it and what was needed and so forth. And they then went off, designed the project, but it was designed and built by a technical team who were very competent. So it's still going strong, and with the new version coming out in 2022. So what's Heurist? It's a software as a service. It's a browser-based database builder running on a number of free services linked together by a central index. And it allows researchers to, or indeed other people, to build complex databases with richly linked heterogeneous data without doing any programming, just through a browser interface. It's primarily designed to collect data, to manage that data, to filter the data into subsets, which can then be visualized, exported, or archived. And of course, a subset can be the whole database as well. And it's aimed at humanities researchers, small teams without technical support, individuals, including PhD and other sorts of research students, and amateur researchers and so forth, anybody, in fact, that needs to build a database. And interestingly, it's increasingly being used by overstretched IT support departments or humanities IT support departments, such as humanities engineers in the French system, who are able to build a database very quickly for somebody's needs and then pass it over to them and leave them to do most of the future work on it and just help when required. So because Heurist allows instant structure changes on a live database, the researchers can just get on with it themselves. When they need a new field, when they need a new type of entity, they can simply make the changes themselves, and they don't have to wait around waiting for technical people to be able to build it for them. So this is what it looks like. Here are three versions of the interface, starting with an early one in early 20s, early zeros rather, brown, running through to a slightly more modern interface, the current version. In fact, those interfaces do much the same. On the left, you have a navigation, which is through saved filter subsets. You have in the middle, you have a result set that corresponds with the saved filter or search. And on the right, you have a visualization based on that filtering. And the thing we've added also in the last two or three years is we've integrated into the new version the CMS Web Portal Builder, which allows people to create a website extremely rapidly, just a few clicks, edit it through the normal interface of Heurist, you edit it in a WYSIWYG editor, insert different types of components, fiddle with the CSS and all of that through a relatively easy to use interface. And with using that, we can also build quite different complicated websites of various types. So one of the problems we have in developing infrastructure is the 1 to 3 year funding cycle, which is typical of much research funding, which means that it's hard to get hold of and to find and to keep technical staff for the whole of a project. And so projects which don't have technical support provided by their institutions often have a hard time finding the right people, finding them quickly, getting things up and running quickly. And the result is often ad hoc, one-off programming, hiring a consultant for a lot of money, or assemblages of tools put together by people who are not particularly skilled or trained in the niceties of IT, which results in costly, poorly integrated, hard to maintain systems, which can end up being very expensive as a result and have poor sustainability. So what tends to happen is reinvention of the square wheel. And what we want to avoid is reinventing the square wheel. And the solution we feel is a mutualized single code base, open source development, which provides free centralized services, free and centralized maintenance, rather than every project having to look after their own servers and databases and so forth. The schemas are stored as editable data rather than fixed database structures with fixed tables. And the advantage there is that the schema can be edited at any time. And because the interface is built dynamically from the schema, the system simply rebuilds the interface from any changes that are made. So there's no extra work and the data that's already in the database remains untouched or undamaged. And we particularly emphasize demand-driven priority development, which means when somebody comes along and needs something that can't be done with the existing interface and the existing database, we define what's needed in generic terms rather than specific terms. We develop that and that becomes a new feature of the software that's then available to everybody. And the result is basically the Heuris software and service. So its evolution has been basically in 2005 to 2009 was a very experimental phase when it was really internal use and anything went. We added stuff, different programmers added in different stuff in different ways, there were very few rules, and we added a lot of stuff that's never been used since. Between 2009 and 2012, we consolidated all this, redesigned the database structure, standardized it, and it's been backward compatible ever since. We made it available to external users, we put in a different schema per database, we built the central index, and everything was reasonably well documented. We made it open source in 2013, we made it a much better explicit client server structure in 2015, further consolidation through the late teens, and we redesigned in 2020 the interface with a professional UX designer and integrated the integrated CMS website builder to produce the version that we have now. So our philosophy has been very much a pragmatic development philosophy. Given that we have scarce resources, we try to maximize functionality. Good enough will do. We don't try to be perfect. We don't worry if it's the fastest. We use our advanced users as alpha testers, and they're pretty happy to do it because if they ask for things, they get them very quickly, sometimes the same day, sometimes the next day, depending on how big they are. And also, we do very quick bug fixing. So if people report a bug, if it's in any way hinders them from doing things, we either give them a workaround within a few hours or within a day, or we fix the bug straight away if it's a small one that we can fix very often. And so it's a form of extreme programming. I wouldn't suggest that we are masters of extreme programming. We have our own particular quirky ways of doing things, one of which in fact is to use Google Docs to keep all of our current work, because it's a very flexible visual way of organizing information. We also keep all our backlog in a Heuris database for tracking all the backlog jobs. Secondly, we maintain backward database compatibility back to 2013, version 3. And one of the ways we've done that are to we avoid removing or reordering fields, so that even if that's not entirely, it would be nice to be able to move things around and get rid of stuff we no longer use. We prefer to keep them because that way we don't break things. And in fact, we make additive changes such as new tables and new fields in the MySQL database, which tend not to break anything. There are one or two places which are sensitive to their existence or non-existence. We know where they are, so when we make additions, we can go and fix that. We use an auto-version detection system, which will automatically run one or more update scripts to bring an old database up to the current standard. And we use a system of what we call concept IDs, which are universal to the Heuris system and unique across all databases, across all servers, which allow us to check whether particular record types, entity types, and fields, which might be required for something like the CMS or mapping or bibliography, whether they're present in the database. And if they're not, it can go off, find the structure, and import the required entities into the database from the source database. That has a nice side effect, is that if you export an XML file from any Heuris database that's been registered with the central index, it can be imported into any other Heuris database, whether or not it has the same structure, because it will go off and find the right structure elements, bring them in, and then import the file. And we have a set of monitoring and reporting scripts to run on the servers, which send us email when things go wrong. Which means we normally pick up within a few hours or maybe minutes that something's wrong, and we can go and reset the Apache server or MySQL or whatever if things have gone wrong. We use a conservative approach to development. So if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We don't chase after the latest standards. We don't keep on changing framework. We prefer to invest time in new features rather than keeping up with the Joneses. And we'd rather have a system which works, but is maybe not the fastest or perhaps not the easiest, than having a better system which doesn't actually work at all. So it's one of the reasons why I use many of the same tools. We're still using MySQL and PHP that we started with, in fact, before 2005. And we use a small targeted internal client server framework rather than jumping on the latest framework, which will run out. And we've, of course, migrated some of the libraries we use, such as GMAPS to Leaflet. But we try and be very conservative about our changes because we want the system to keep on working all the time. Then we have a pretty good uptime. And finally, as I've said before, the database schemas are stored as data, which means the underlying SQL database structure doesn't change at all. It's the same for all databases. That makes it much easier to maintain. We can have a single software stack which works on all databases. We implement database patterns in the software, and therefore we can easily modify, people can edit the schema on the fly, and the database interface is rebuilt for them on the fly, because it's generated on the fly in any case. So there's no rebuilding of the database or loss of data or anything like that. It also means that we can move sections of schema across between these databases, as I've mentioned before, which means that we encourage reusability and standardization without imposing technical constraints that you have to have specific functions or that you have to move things around in particular ways. And it's all based on the system of concept IDs. So this is our website, heurisnetwork.org. You can find the links to the GitHub repository for Heurist. You can find instructions for installing it, downloadable packages, an invitation to come and participate in the open source development. One of the advantages in working with us is we have lots and lots of very interesting projects around the world. So it can be a good way to get involved in things in places like the Atacama Desert or Paris, whichever suits you better. So please feel free to contact me or to contact support@heurisnetwork.org if you're interested in working with us or finding out more about Heurist. Thank you very much for your attention. Bye.